We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Being here at the University of Illinois, we're very fortunate that a lot of interesting folks come through town. They come to the university to talk about what they do. And among these group of people, you know, we have various kinds of folks. We have hard scientists and we have social scientists and we have writers and we have poets. And I'm really glad always to have the opportunity to talk with someone like that about their writing. And the guest that we have this morning is one such person. We'll be talking with Kathy Day. She's here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Reading Series. This is something that's housed within the Department of English here at the University of Illinois. And they bring writers here to talk about their work, to talk with students. She will be giving a reading this afternoon on the campus. That's at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4:30 in the afternoon at the Author's Corner, and that's something that's open to anybody who is interested in attending. We will try and talk a little bit about her two books, The Circus in Winter, which is a book that is, at least in part, inspired by the place that she grew up, a town in Indiana that is known as the circus capital of the world because several major shows spent their off-season there. Her second book was a memoir, Comeback Season, How I Learned to Play the Game of Love, which indeed looks at the search for love and the search for victory on the field by the Indianapolis Colts in 2006. She's working on a new novel. It's about Cole Porter, mm-hmm. who also was born there in Piru, Indiana, where she grew up. And we'll talk about all of these. We'll talk about writing. And, of course, for the people who are listening, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also shoot us an email if you'd like to join in the conversation that way. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
I think that it is true that for people who are really driven to write, certainly people who write fiction, and I think actually a lot of journalists, the thing that drives them is this really intense desire to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
Different people, maybe different kinds of stories, but the storytelling impulse is real strong. So having said that, what kind of stories attract you?
The kind of stories that attract me, I guess, are the stories that have holes in them, where my brain says to, as I'm reading something maybe in a newspaper or looking at a photograph, I ask myself, what is that person doing in that photograph? How did they get there? I actually began life as a journalist, as a journalism major, and I thought that that's the kind of writer I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. But I quickly realized, actually, Circus in Winter began life as nonfiction. But whenever I came to a place where I didn't know the answer and I wasn't able to find an answer, my brain started to make up a story to explain that absence. And luckily, I decided to call myself a fiction writer instead of I call what I do non-fictional fiction in that most of my stories begin with something that that really happened either to me or to someone else. They begin with research. Somebody else might do the exact same thing that I do and write a biography or a work of, of history. I call it fiction because there comes a point where in telling my story, I go so far away from what really happened or what could be proven to happen that to me, it's fiction at that point. It's a story.
Well, tell us about the place where you grew up.
Mm-hmm. Peru was the winter quarters of the Hagenbeck Wallace Circus at the turn of the century. For many years, up until about the 1940s, it's the place where if you worked for that circus or a couple of other circuses related to it, that's where you spent your winter months. It's the place that for many people, once they retired from the circus, it's the only place they'd ever really thought of as home. Mm-hmm. There was a family that lived next door to my grandparents, the Hajinis, and they were a famous – their name is actually Hodges, but they went by Hajini because that was their show name. And they lived next door to my grandparents, and they were former circus people who settled in Peru had their kids but kept a trapeze bar and a trampoline in their backyard. And, you know, that's pretty common in my hometown. The famous Clyde Beatty, the animal trainer, his family still lives in Peru. The children of Emmett Kelly, the famous clown, Weary mm-hmm. Willie, that's where they've settled. And so the town is populated by a lot of people who have this sort of circus lineage. My circus lineage is very kind of faint. My great aunt married the son of a man who was killed by an elephant. He was an elephant trainer. And that's my claim to fame. And that's actually what led me to this book, is that when I went to college, people would say, well, where are you from? And I would say, well, you know, I'm from this little town. It's nowhere, middle of nowhere. And people would say, well, then there's the circus. And then that would make everybody sit up and take notice. And the story I like to tell was that my great-great-uncle was killed by an elephant. And the skull of the elephant sits in the town museum. And nobody believed me. So the book started as a way just to prove to people that it really did happen.
Yeah. There seem to be few institutions that have the mix of stuff that get attached to circus. All of the childish sort of delight and excitement, and then all of the really gothic, strange, creepy stuff that also that attach to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it such a complicated thing?
Why are so many people attracted to the idea of circus? Is that what you mean?
Well, and why also at the same time does it have this really sort of dark, odd, sort of strange aspect to it?
I don't know why some people think of it as many people, the circus is filled with the nostalgia of their childhoods. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And for me, it's not like that because, you know, the man who was like the doctor who delivered me was like a clown. So like to me, circus people are just people you know all the time. Does that make sense?
Mm, sure.
But I will agree that it is I'm trying to think, why is it? We live in a world where we are supposed to do the things that are expected of us and the circus is this opportunity to either witness other people going against those rules, or we romanticize the idea that we could do that in some way too. And I think that is one of the reasons that so many people are attracted to it, because it represents, in our sort of subconscious, it represents like going against the rules of society. You know, you're not supposed to have wild animals running around. You're not supposed to wear makeup and do crazy things, or to push your body to limits that defy, you know, sort of the limits of physical strength. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
So it's an opportunity to sort of like it was the primary form of entertainment in this country for quite a while, and before movies, and then we got movies, and then we became not so entertained by the circus anymore.
Yeah, and too, I think it seems that there's this temptation, there's this desire, I think, there's the show, there's the part of it that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's also this temptation. What you want to do is you want to go over to the curtains, you want to mm-hmm. pull them apart just a little bit, and you want to see what's behind it. And maybe we recognize in the other things that entertain us that there's the front of the house and then there's the back of the house. But somehow this is a place where maybe there's some possibility you can actually get into the back of the house, and in other kinds of things you don't.
Well, the circus, when it would come to town, mm-hmm. You would go to the circus the whole day, and they mm-hmm. would actually put their back, they called it the back lot. They would put the back lot on display. You would walk around and you would watch them feeding the animals, and you would watch, you know, the clowns in Clown Alley putting on their makeup. So to an extent, it was an almost completely transparent form of entertainment. And they took advantage of that. They wanted – you wanted to feel like you were seen behind the scenes.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. This – the thing that sort of sets the whole thing in motion is that you have a character in the book who lives in this the fictional town,
mm-hmm.
Lima.
Lima.
Mm-hmm. Which stands in for the place where you grew up. And there's a man there. He's a businessman. He's a successful businessman. And one day the circus comes to town.
Right.
And the guy who's running the circus is – not real happy with the whole thing. And what happens is that this man, the local businessman, he buys the circus.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's, again, that's one of those little bits of fantasy. I don't know how much that's a fantasy people have anymore. But that must have at one time for a lot of people been one of those things you would have thought to yourself, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be cool to have my own circus?
Wouldn't it be? That's partly based in reality. The guy from my hometown, his name was Ben Wallace, and he was the owner of a livery stable. And as the story goes, a struggling circus came through town, and they needed to put up their animals for the night in his stables. And that's kind of how it happened. He just sort of bought, it was a sound business move. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It maybe sound romantic to us, but, you know, P.T. Barnum and the Ringling Brothers and all those people, like this was, like I said, it was the most popular form of entertainment in the country. And so in a sense, these men who bought circuses were also sort of, you know, doing what made good fiscal sense to a certain extent. It's crazy to think that taking a bunch of people and animals all over the country is a sound business decision. But
yeah.
But it was.
Well, particularly if you really hadn't been in that business and maybe you had no idea just what exactly was involved in doing that.
It's one thing that's interesting is that during World War I, the army went to the Ringling Brothers and the men who owned the circuses in this country to ask them, like, how do you move so much stuff from place to place that mm-hmm. our tactics for transporting lots of people and animals and stuff in war, we learned from circus owners. I find that really fascinating because they knew how to do it.
Mm. Are there other characters in the book that have, you know, some little thing, some real person, some story that you mm-hmm. heard or someone that you knew, then it grew into characters that
have
in the book?
There's actually quite a few. If you're a circus aficionado, there's probably people that you would recognize in the book. The second story in the book is called Jenny Dixiana, and she's basically a fictional Lillian Leitzel. Lillian Leitzel was a celebrity at the turn of the century. She was an aerialist who would hang from a rope. And she would swivel and gyrate with her arm, and she would dislocate her shoulder with each gyration. And she would do this 50 to 100 times a night. She was very famous. And then she fell and she died. It was very tragic. Another character in the book is – his name is Tony Colorado, and he's based on Tom Mix, mm-hmm. who spent – for a while, he traveled. After he sort of failed to move from silent films to talkies, he apparently had a very high voice and it didn't sound very good. He started a circus and traveled, and he spent his time in Peru. So there are actually quite a few characters who sort of have an analogous sort of real circus history, you know, sort of attachment.
Yeah. The story of the woman who does this act that's so physically demanding and painful and punishing, I think it also maybe invites you to think about how one of the things about the circus is that and maybe other things, it's the same. There are things that are – people do things that are very physically demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And yet part of the performance is to make it look easy,
mm-hmm.
like anybody could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe writing is a little bit that way too.
Mm-hmm.
But in so many art forms, part of the deal is – You got to make it. It ain't easy, but you got to make it look easy.
Right, and you have to do. You have to have talent, but you also have to do a lot of practicing so that stay in shape to a certain mm-hmm. extent. So that the if you get out of shape, you could actually be risking your life if you're a circus performer. And to a certain extent, writing is about both. I firmly believe that writing is about both talent and effort.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Kathy Day. She's the author of the books The Circus in the Winter, that's the one that we're talking about, and also her memoir Comeback Season, How I Learned to Play the Game of Love. She teaches at Ball State,
mm-hmm.
is that right?
Yep.
In Muncie.
Mm-hmm.
And she's here visiting the campus to talk about writing. She'll be spending time with students, but she'll also be doing a reading, and this is open to anybody who'd like to stop by and meet her, see her, hear her. That's at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore on the campus this afternoon at 4:30. 4:30. She's here as part of the car reading series. And we've been happy over time to have a number of people who are visiting here, poets, novelists, people who write stories, to talk about their work. And questions are certainly welcome. In fact, we have somebody here who'd like to join us, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the caller is in Vermilion County, next door. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Was the Hardini family originally from England?
Yes, they were.
Well, I was so intrigued by this because about 10 years ago, I volunteered for a week working in the Circus Museum at Baraboo.
Uh-huh. Yep, I've been there.
And one of my jobs was to transcribe the diary of a young woman named Mary Hodges, but she went by the name of Hardini. And the thing that I remember, I believe they were heiress, but she started keeping company with a man who was, you know, the advance man for the Ringling Brothers Circus. And she talked about their date, and they eventually married, but on one of the dates, why she said at the bottom of the diary, "My first kiss." And unfortunately, this man died not too long after they were married, and he was buried in a cemetery at St. Louis. But one thing I did copy from her diary was her recipe for a one-egg cake. And it just caught me when you mentioned that family, and I was so intrigued by this diary that I thought I would mention it to you.
Well, thank you. That was probably a relative of her name's Karen Hodgini. She was my babysitter growing up, and so that was probably like a great aunt or of hers.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. This woman, I believe her name was Mary or Marie. But I'm not sure. But that name, Hodgini, it's just... Oh, speaking of winter quarters, the Baraboo winter quarters
Is
something special.
They have a large display at the Baraboo Circus Museum devoted to the Hodgini family.
They do? I wonder if that's why they gave me her diary to...
Yeah, they probably did. It was very interesting for me after growing up in Peru and knowing this family just as the family that lived next door to my grandparents to actually go to the Baraboo Museum and see how sort of famous they were in the sort of in the circus world. When you grow up in Peru, like they're like, oh yeah, well they owned the camera store in my town. So they were, I mean, people knew that they actually helped start the amateur circus in Peru. They trained... Karen's parents taught the kids in town to perform, and the kids in my town still put on a circus every summer. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing, and they started it.
Well, that's interesting. Well, thank you for your book.
Well, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We email will-talk@illinois.edu. I know I read you had maybe a little bit of trepidation as you were working on the book and maybe before it was published because you were wondering, well, people in this town, the circus and this heritage, and this means a lot to them, and you were a little bit concerned about if people read the book, what they might think.
Yeah, I think anybody who writes about a small town, especially if they're from a small town, worries about this. I don't know. For me, calling the town Lima instead of Peru really allowed me to make things up and to make the stories as good as they could be. I called it Peru for a long time, but I couldn't get out of my head the fact that every time somebody in the local paper in Peru would get something wrong, there would be like this flood of you know, letters to the editor. You know, people pay attention to that stuff. And I said, oh, my God, I'm going to get that. So in a way, I needed to call it something else to prevent myself from like sticking so close to the facts, being so worried about what people would think.
Yeah. Would you feel like maybe you're reading a little something from Circus in Winter so people can get a sense for the book?
How long would you like me to read?
Oh, a couple minutes is
okay. I'm going to maybe read from the – it's actually the last story. I think it kind of gets to the heart to me about what the book is about. When I was little, my mother told me that there are basically two kinds of people in the world, town people and circus people. The kind who stay are town people, and the kind who leave are circus people. Dad used to tell me that I'm a lot like my mother, but this worries him, like I'm cursed, like he somehow failed to give me more of himself. And I have to admit that the part of me that's like my mother scares me more than a little. It's a fire that burns hot and bright, and I know if I let it get out of control, I'll turn into flecks of scorched paper and blow away. But that fire also gave me the courage to leave Lima and make the life I wanted, for which I'm thankful. At the college where I teach now, I'm surrounded by circus people. We aren't tightrope walkers or acrobats. We don't breathe fire or swallow swords. We're gypsies, moving wherever there's work to be found. Our scrapbooks and photo albums bear witness to our vagabond lives. College years, grad school years, instructor mill years, first job years. In between each stage is a picture of old friends helping to fill a truck with boxes and furniture. We pitch our tents, and that place becomes home for a while. We make families from colleagues and students, lovers and neighbors. And when that place is no longer working, we don't just make do. We move on to the place that's next. No place is home. Every place is home. Home is our stuff. As much as I love the Cumberland Valley at twilight, I probably won't live there forever. And this doesn't really scare me, and that's how I know that I'm circus people.
That's Kathy Day. She's reading from her book there, Circus in Winter. She grew up in Peru, Indiana, a place that was a winter quarters for a couple of big circuses. Mm-hmm. And it was that provided some of the inspiration that ended up being this book. She teaches at Ball State. She's here visiting the campus. And this afternoon, 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore, she'll be giving a reading. So if you'd like to hear more from her, you should stop by. So in these child circus shows there in your town, mm-hmm. did you ever?
No.
No, you were never into that?
Karen tried to get me to do that, but I'm actually very shy. And the thought of putting on a leotard and having the entire town be able to look at me was just way too much for me to contemplate when I was a young person. So, no. But many kids in the town did participate. And actually, some of the kids from my town have actually gone on to be professional circus performers or stunt people who are really well trained, or they've come back to Peru to teach the next generation. My friend Karen, her parents who started the circus, they've passed away, but the kids that they taught how to perform have come back to Peru and settled, and they train the next generation of kids to perform. And mm-hmm. I say this all the time. I wish that more people would go to Peru during the third week of July. It's every year. There's this week-long performances that they put on that are just really, really wonderful.
We have, I think, another caller here. Belgium over next door in Vermilion County. Here is a caller, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to ask a little bit about the circus. It's probably not quite what you've been talking about. As a young person, I traveled all over the United States a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember, and I'm in my mid-60s, so I go back a little ways. And as a young child, I remember Ringling Brothers coming into one of the towns I lived. And then I also remember at some of the other places I lived, other types of circuses coming in. There was like 2 and 3 different types of circuses I remember mm-hmm. as a child. There was the circus like you're talking about that came in full blown with they'd put the tin up. And I can remember coming in as a train as a very young lad, and they did all the performers and everything. And then I also remember, and I want to be polite about how I put this, the oddity shows.
Yeah, the freak shows.
The freak shows, okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't really want to say that, but the freak shows. And sometimes they weren't actually associated with the circus. They would come in at other times sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then there were the carnival type people that would mm-hmm. just, you know. Now, they're a little different yet, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then about 10 years ago, I remember the last traveling circus I ever saw, and it was kind of a pitiful sort of thing. It was a guy that had like two semi-trucks, and he had one elephant, and it was more or less a menagerie,
mm-hmm.
kind of really falling off. It seems as though the traveling circus has done that, kind of really gone way downhill when it comes to that sort of thing.
Right.
And I was wondering if you had any opinions or thoughts about those sort of things.
Well, I mean, I think an argument could be made that traveling with large exotic animals isn't really interesting to people anymore because they have zoos. And we are also much more bothered by seeing animals in captivity than we were 100 years ago. And I also think that as far as the, you know, the cultural need for circuses is sort of gone, because once we had television, once we were able, I mean, you know, there's a line in Circus and Winter, it says, you know, a circus brings a small town as much of the outside world as it can bear. And, you know, if you grew up in a small town in this country at a certain time, the circus really was, it was a huge deal to be able to go see these kinds of things. And it's no longer a huge deal once we had television. Now we have the internet. Who needs to have a circus come to your town? You can go on the internet and you can see a freak show anytime you want. So I think that that's one of the reasons that it's interesting to me that some people, though, are still very committed to, you know, trying to make the circus continue to happen in one way or another. But the audiences just aren't there. And I think it's interesting that, like, my nephews will grow up in a world where the circus won't mean anything to them the way it means something culturally to people who are your age or even my age.
And there is no such thing as a freak show anymore, is there?
Not really. I mean, not
like they used to have.
Not like they used to have, because I mean, for good reason. we don't feel the same way we do about people who have abnormalities. You know, there used to be tattooed people, and we used to pay money to look at them, and now people walk around and they're tattooed all the time. So it's just not the same.
Thank you very much.
Right, no problem. Thank you.
I want to ask you a writing question, and
sure.
I think this is something that I'm sure you've thought about, because you've said, in fact, that you're one of the things that you talk with young writers about is moving from writing stories to writing novels.
Mm-hmm.
The Circus in Winter is one of those novels that's a linked story collection.
Right.
And it's something that I think in recent years we're starting to see more and more of.
Mm-hmm.
Not that nobody ever did that before, but it's something we're starting to see more and more of. And I also expect that as a writer, maybe you have struggled with this, with somebody, people's arguing that, well, real writers write novels.
Right.
And that this is something, you know, you can write stories and you can write collections of stories, but then the pinnacle of being a writer is writing novels.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is actually, anybody who's interested in, like, how do I write a novel? Come to my talk today at 4:30, because I'm actually going to be reading from an essay I've been working on. I'd like to turn it into a book. It's called The Big Thing, Moving from Stories to Book. And this issue, I think, one of the things that's happened is that literary production in this country has become very tied to academia. The writing workshop has become the incubator for most writers in this country. And the story is the thing that is most analogous to the paper. It is something that you can begin and sort of complete in the course of a semester. And so I was taught to write by learning how to write short stories. Although growing up, I never read short stories. I read novels. And so I really, you know, part of the reason that Circus in Winter, you know, I think many people would say, like, you know, I had agents actually say to me, like, I'll take you on if you'll turn this into a novel. And to be honest, I didn't know how to do it. I wanted it to be like Winesburg, Indiana. That's what I mm-hmm. wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. But then I finished the book and I said, okay, now I really want to embark and learn about how to engage a reader past page 25. How do I do that? And a couple different ways that I think the way I taught myself how to do this, and I'm teaching classes sort of trying to get my students to think about this, is you have to, like, in the same way when you build a house, you lay a foundation, you put up the frame, you do things in stages. When you build a one-room house, you do it foundation to finish, but you don't build a house by working on the kitchen foundation to finish, working on the living room foundation to finish. You sort of have to be willing to have this manuscript that is sort of untidy and yucky and a mess and doesn't really look like anything for a long time. And if you're in a semester where you have to produce something that's finished for a grade, you're like, hi, here's my horrible first draft of my novel. Please grade it, you know. And I've actually been trying a bunch of different ways to sort of change how I teach and also how I write as a way to sort of move past that sort of only thinking about things in terms of story.
Hmm. Well, I guess myself, I don't know why it is that someone should look at a novel, say a more conventional novel, and look at something like Circus in Winter or a book that's structured more like that and somehow say that that is less than the other.
Well,
I guess
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, some of my favorite books are books that are, you know, novels and stories, like mm-hmm. The Things They Carried, like Winesburg, Ohio, like Love Medicine by, you know, Louise Erdrich. There's many examples of this. And I really like – I think that contemporary audiences are much more okay with non-chronological, non-linear storytelling, thanks to Lost. Thank God for Lost. People are much more used to these things now. But most people – you know, I went around and I visited a lot of book clubs after Circus in Winter came out, and I really listened to what these people were telling me about what they like to read and, like, why they read. And they said, I like to be in something for a couple of days or weeks. I want to disappear into this. It's like – it's the same reason why I think people like to rent a show like The Wire on Netflix and watch it. Those have become sort of like our novels. We sort of get into those shows and experience them like novels, as opposed to Law and Order, which is like a short story collection. Law and Order is like a beginning, middle, and end each episode. You get your story fix. Sometimes you feel like a story fix, and sometimes you feel like disappearing into something for a while. And so it's training yourself to – I don't know. I don't exactly remember how this question got started, but I do think that it is possible. And it's not that I think that novels are more valid or more important. It's that they provide a completely different kind of experience, and it is challenging if you have been only sort of thinking about, like, you know, are sprint trainers less athletes than marathoners? No, it's just a different kind of. It's just a different kind of activity.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Kathy Day, she teaches English at Ball State in Muncie and is author of the books The Circus in Winter and Comeback Season. The Circus in Winter is a novel. Comeback Season is a memoir. She's here visiting the campus to talk about her writing. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, now let's shift a little bit to talk about something different. And I'd like you to talk about Comeback Season mm-hmm. and how that really got started.
Well, Comeback Season is how I taught myself how to write a novel, in that it is a nonfiction novel. It is a novel. It is a novel-length reading experience. And I guess I suck at plot. Let's be frank. You know, I've realized this. I really do. Like, part of the reason I write nonfictional fiction is that it's very hard for me. It's very hard to sort of make things up out of whole cloth, to actually imagine the way I would compare Comeback Season to, you know, something else is to think of it as like a documentary. Did you see Super Size Me, the Morgan Spurlock thing about eating McDonald's?
I guess I know what it's about. Right. I didn't actually see
that. Well, you know, a document, you know, Morgan Spurlock decided to eat McDonald's food for a month. And during the course of that month, he shot over 250 hours worth of footage and then distilled that down to the hour and a half movie that we ended up with. And for me, writing, I call it not a memoir, but more of a, they call it an immersion memoir, in that mm-hmm. I'm only looking back at something that I did last year. It's not like I'm looking back at my childhood or anything like that. But I had all the raw material. It was about just sort of arranging it and figuring out what belonged and what didn't. I found this enormously comforting as someone who couldn't really figure out how do you sustain a plot past page 25, to actually begin with way more plot than you need, and then to figure out, like, well, how do you shape it? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So for me, that was how I recommend this to a lot of people, to sort of teach yourself how to write, go from story to book, is to sort of think about things that already have a frame. Like, you know what I mean? Start with the skeleton that's already there and then figure out how to build on top of that, or to have more than you need and sort of take things away to form the plot.
Yeah. This is very personal. I mean, this was you certainly putting yourself there.
Yeah. Yeah. The conceit of the book is that I had just moved to Pittsburgh. It was 2005. And I don't know if anybody remembers this, but the Colts lost to the Pittsburgh Steelers in the playoffs. And like the 2005 season, it was 2006. Yeah. Mike Vanderjack, you know, like missed this field goal and Jerome Bettis fumbled the ball and it was just this. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm a Colts fan living in Pittsburgh and my team just completely blew it. And like they always blow it in the playoffs, and at least up until then. And I had just after, you know, years and years of sort of focusing on my career, I had, well, let's put it this way. 9 of the men that I have dated in my life married the woman that they met after me, directly after me. So I sort of, in a way, I felt, in the way that I think a lot of fans do, I felt this personal connection to what the Colts were feeling as they lost again. Does that make sense? I was like, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, why does this keep happening to us? Because a guy, I had been dating someone and he just kind of said, no, I don't want to date you anymore. So I wanted to try to figure out, I needed a plan of action. I needed to turn my life into, to do something that was difficult for me. So I basically said, I will try to date over the course of an entire football season. And I will sort of try to sort of, in a sense, be victorious. There's a quote at the beginning of the book. Vince Lombardi said that a football game is basically comprised of about 150 plays. Only 4 or 5 of those plays really make the difference between winning and losing. But you don't know which ones those are going to be. So you have to go all out on every play. And so I sort of lived my life like that for about 6 months during the course of a football season. It was basically the try everything philosophy. And what's interesting, I thought, oh, sure, this won't be so hard, you know. And I found actually that it was quite hard. And it was – but I needed to find a way to sort of keep myself inspired to keep going. And for me, as somebody who grew up with like the sports metaphors, sports movies, sports heroes, that's how I sort of like – pumped myself up to keep going.
Yeah. And how's that whole area of your life going right now?
Well, what ended up happening is that at the end of the book, you know, there's not some sort of pat happy ending at all. At the end of the book, I actually break up with someone that I'm not actually getting along very well with, and the Colts win the Super Bowl. So there was a happy ending there. The Colts won. After the book came out, I was on a radio station just like this talking to someone in Indianapolis, WFYI's Art of the Matter. And an old friend of mine from college heard me on the radio as he was driving to the grocery store. And as this happens a lot, I'll probably get, you know, people calling me after this saying, oh, I remember you. I went to high school with you or something. And he got back in touch with me and we started corresponding and we got married about a year later. So I did.
Worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
About 10 minutes left in this hour with Kathy Day. I have a caller here. We'll just go right to them. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Comment on how much money these people made over time. And did Roustabouts get a small salary?
Oh.
And then was there an association, like a benevolent one, to care for people who had accidents or had to retire? Okay.
Ah.
We're back to the circus.
Roustabouts were typically hired sort of on site. They were paid in cash usually, and there was not very much done in terms of record keeping. There is actually a memorial it's called the Showman's Rest. It's actually a memorial up near Chicago. There was a horrible train accident involving the Hagenbeck Wallace Circus at the turn of the century. This circus train was hit from behind. There was like a mistake with the tracks and all these people died. And there's actually quite a few people that they couldn't identify because they'd taken them on at the last town and never wrote down who they were. They had no way to even contact people to let them know that their loved ones had died. So, you know, this is something that I don't really know that much about, but like there's no like, you know, 401k plan or anything when you join the circus. It was, you know, more like they used a lot of itinerant laborers in the way that I think a lot of businesses do to kind of, you know, do the dirty work.
Yeah. So did some performers make lots of money?
Oh, yeah. I mean, some, but not everybody, you know.
The big stars.
The big stars, of course, did. And they had agents, and they were like movie stars to a certain extent. They were the equivalent of of what we now consider to be celebrities, entertainment celebrities. They were the entertainment celebrities of their time.
We have about 10 minutes in this part of Focus. Kathy Day is our guest. She teaches at Ball State in Muncie. She is the author of Circus in Winter and Comeback Season, How I Learned to Play the Game of Love. She's visiting the campus here as part of the Carr Reading Series for the fall. It's a series where they bring writers, poets, to the campus so that students can talk with them about writing, and then they always give readings. And Kathy will be doing a reading this afternoon on the campus at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner, 4:30 in the afternoon. Anybody who would like to stop by is welcome to do that. And her books are out, and if you'd like to read Circus in Winter or Comeback Season, go down to the bookstore and look for the books. We have about 10 minutes left. Cole Porter. Let's talk about Cole Porter.
The book is actually called Mrs. Cole Porter. It's a book about, of course, being from Peru, I was always very interested in the fact that this other person from my town had sort of made a life for himself, made a name for himself. And in reading information about his life, I found this sort of weird footnote, which was that when his wife died, she asked to be buried in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where she had a beautiful mansion. And he agreed and buried her in my hometown against her wishes. She's still there. I rode my bike past her gravesite all the time growing up. And also, this was like her most precious place in the world. And he blew up her house with dynamite and then moved his bachelor's cottage onto the foundation of her house when she died. It's in every single Cole Porter biography. And all the Cole Porter biographers say, you know, he did that because he missed her so much. And I just think that's crap. I'm sorry my language, but I just think there's like I said, like there's a
little,
story there.
Little anger there.
I think there's a story there, and I kind of resolved to tell it. And it's actually very, hard to tell Linda's story because there's not a lot. Nobody who's interested in Cole Porter really pays her a lot of attention because she's sort of in the background. But the more I've done research, the more I'm convinced that – And I know it sounds crazy to move from like talking about football and dating to talking about Cole Porter, but really these two things are linked because part of what I was trying to do with Comeback Season is figure out how do I find a marriage that will allow me to do the work that I need to do in this world? Do you know what I mean? Like to be an artist and to be a professional. And it's very hard to find men who are who are down with that, at least of my generation,
Yeah.
And that's basically what, Cole Porter was homosexual and his wife was his confidant, his best friend, and I think his publicity manager. And so, like, she is the reason that we sing those songs. The reason that we know those songs is because she provided the money and the space and the inspiration and the protection that he needed for the 10 years that he spent sort of like figuring out who he was going to be as an artist. And I think that, and then to blow up her house just struck me as like sort of the height of irony in terms of like showing some thankfulness for that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what my book is about.
Yeah. Do you, as we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there are characters in the circus in Winter that are inspired by people that you knew. So there you took a little bit of something and then grew up. Person around that.
Right.
As a writer, if you were dealing with characters like Cole Porter and his wife, who were definitely real people,
right,
and a lot is known about them, how do you approach the idea of dealing with a character that essentially is somebody who existed rather than someone who you are making up out of whole cloth?
Yeah. It's the first day that I wrote some dialogue where Cole Porter was talking. It was very weird. I'm like, I'm putting words in Cole Porter's mouth. It was odd. But, there's other characters who are in Linda, his wife, was a contemporary of Edith Wharton and Emily Post. In fact, Cole Porter's first wife or Cole Porter's wife, her first husband was business partners with Emily Post's husband. I know that sounds crazy, but they were friends. Mm-hmm. So I'm using them as characters as well. I guess it took some getting used to at first, but to get over the fact that they are both real people, but I'm also sort of like I'm not making them do things that are completely out of the realm of possibility. But it's really not that much different than I think what E.L. Doctorow did this in Ragtime, for example. He used Harry Houdini and Evelyn Nesbitt. And a lot of real historical figures as characters. And I think that people are very interested in sort of that whole idea. Mm-hmm. And I know I, as someone who makes up stories in my head, it's really not that much different than a kind of fan fiction in a way, the way that people will make up a story about characters from their favorite show. To a certain extent, these are characters from that I'm sort of like sort of taking what I know about them and sort of pushing it to the next level.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, also there are, I know that there are some writers who look at that, say what Doctorow has been so famous mm-hmm. for or what you're talking about here. And they look at it with some mild and maybe not so mild irritation because they say something like, look, you're a writer. Come on, make a character up. Don't take Teddy Roosevelt and make him the hero of your novel. Make up your own darn character. You're a writer.
Well, I mean, all I can say is that I have plenty of characters that I've made up out of whole cloth, and I'm creating some for the book. But I guess, you know, just part of being a writer is learning how you are inclined to work. Mm-hmm. And if this is how I'm inclined to work, and if this is sort of what works for me, then, you know, let somebody else make up their characters out of whole cloth. That's what I do. This is what I do.
All right. About 4 or 5 minutes left. We have somebody in Indiana to bring in here. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to call because I'm from Logansport.
Hi.
And hi. And it's nice to, you know, sort of like when this is over, I'm going to go out and make a few phone calls and say, I talked to that lady. And by the way, I had a boss for a period of time. I worked in quality control over in Peru in a cheese factory.
Uh-huh. Yep.
She had 2 children who both went through the what we call amateur circuit.
Yep, yep.
I've seen it, and it's about as far from amateur as you can get.
I know. It's wonderful. They're very professional.
It certainly needs to have the horn blown about that, and it's nice to hear that you're doing that because this one girl fell off about 30 feet, broke her arm, and
oh.
My God, she went right back doing it. You know, it's just remarkable. And certainly character building for those kids.
Yeah.
And I'll just hop off. It's been very nice to listen to you talk. It's nice to hear an intelligent woman from Peru. If that makes any sense.
One thing I'd like to mention, if I could, before we go away, is that one of the, you know, at Ball State University, there's a group of students who spent a semester adapting The Circus in Winter into a musical. Okay, it's awesome. That's all I want to say. I don't know anything about musicals, which is maybe why I'm writing a book about Cole Porter. I shouldn't really say that, but it's a wonderful musical, and they're going to be staging it at Ball State next fall. It's actually pretty incredible, beautiful music, beautifully produced, and I'm really excited about it. If you're a fan of The Circus in Winter or you know about Peru and you'd like to see a musical made out of it, you should definitely try to look on the Ball State website and see if you can find out how to go see it next fall.
And the music was composed by
students? Yes, yes. It was a completely student – Ball State's really famous for – they have these they call it immersive learning. A faculty member will lead students through the making of a project or a product. And a woman named Beth Turcott in theater asked me if I would let students turn the book into a musical. And so there were students who made music, who wrote the dialogue. There are students who are making the sets. It's completely student made. And I mean, I thought, well, yeah, whatever, it's made by students. But it's actually there's a possibility that it's going to get staged off Broadway. So, I mean, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you were particularly before you got married and particularly when you were going through this marathon of meeting guys for a comeback season.
Right.
Really, when you would sit down and you would meet somebody for the first time and you would start talking and he would say to you something like, what do you do? And you said, oh, I'm a writer.
And a college professor.
And a college professor. Did guys really suddenly then start just head for the door?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, you can read the book. I mean, it happened time and time and time and time again. And men always look at me, and you've got this, you can't see it, audience, but he's got this incredulous look on his face. And like when I started, I really didn't believe that it would be that difficult, but I found it to be true. And I can't really explain it, and I don't know why, but I actually got to a point where I would not mention, you know, I had feminist college professors telling me like, oh, don't say that, say that you're a teacher. And these were like feminist college professor colleagues of mine saying, oh, don't say that you're – just say you're a teacher until they get to know you better or you're going to scare them away. True story.
That's very strange. Now, maybe that's just because I have this feeling like probably about 99% of the women I know are college professors, mm-hmm. and they write books. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that doesn't really seem very strange. Like, that's a life form I recognize because because I know so many of them.
Right. And I think that for most people in the world, they don't know anybody who's a college professor or a writer. That sounds like saying that you're like some kind of like, you know, rock star or something. So like, or you're a professional athlete. They're like, what? You know, so most people are just normal people, you know.
So this guy who called you when he heard you
mm-hmm.
on the radio
Eric,
show,
my husband.
What's he do?
Eric is a retired chef, and basically the way our marriage works is that, to a certain extent, he is the wife. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I work, and he is sort of my business manager, and he loves to cook. And, I mean, it's the right kind of marriage, you know? Like, one person works outside the home. We keep it kind of simple so that we can afford to live on my salary. There just aren't a lot of men who can deal with that. And actually, a lot of people have a hard time dealing with that, too. Like, what does he do? But what does he do? What does he do? And it's funny to me because like this is it's a way of life that actually works very well for us.
Yeah. Well, you should invite those people over for dinner.
I know we do all the time.
They can say, "I will show you here. Have some of this." So when do you have some idea when the Cole Porter book might be? I know these things take a lot of work and a long time. When that actually might see print.
Well, I don't have a contract for it right now. Some people are interested in it, but I don't want to sell it until I've written it because I want it to be as good as possible before anybody starts talking about like how they want to market. Like once you sell a book, they start positioning it and marketing it, and I don't want that. I sold Comeback Season before I'd finished it, and I didn't really like that experience. So I would like to finish this one. So I'm doing National Novel Writing Month. I'm on chapter 11 sort of right now. And so I think it's going to take me another year or two to actually finish it.
Well, I know, Ed, one of the things I read about you, you said something about how maybe one of the difficult things that you had to learn, or maybe was still learning, was the whole business of, you know, writing a book is one thing. But then once the book is done, mm-hmm. it's got to be marketed and sold if it's going to go anywhere, and that's a whole nother world.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know how much time we have left because the story that I published in Ninth Letter, I mean, the reason I'm here today is it's a story called Your Book, A Novel and Stories. And if you're interested, look it up. I mean, it's basically the story of what happened to me between writing The Circus in Winter and then like Comeback Season. It was a very different. It's basically a story about marketing, and and yet it's funny.
uh-huh. Well, the Ninth Letter is a literary magazine that lives here at the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. and so people should check it out, and they could find that mm-hmm. and a lot of other good stuff. And also, of course, you can look for Kathy Day's books, The Circus in Winter and Comeback Season, and she will be doing a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. She's here visiting, sponsored by the Carr Reading Series. She teaches at Ball State in Muncie.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for being here.
It's very good to be here.
Appreciate
Thank you so much.
It.